Good afternoon, Juneau. It's just a moment or two before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTLO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Tuesday's Juneau Afternoon here on KTLO. I've got a great lineup of guests for you today. First folks we're going to hear from are going to tell us about the December art classes and some activities that are coming up at the Canvas downtown. And then Nancy DeCherney is going to come over here and bring her short game. The jackpot is on over there, and so she's getting excited about people coming in and playing miniature golf in the middle of the jack. Rachel Jutzler will be by. She'll be talking about her art that's on display at the City Museum. And then at the end of the show, we'll have an update on the middle school sports travel situation. So stay tuned for that. It's Juneau Afternoon here on KTOO. Going to get cold tonight, by the way. It's going down between 2 and 11 degrees. So if you have one of those faucets that needs to drip when it gets to that temperature, you better turn it on tonight.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa is working to address the digital divide by improving the high-speed fiber optic network on the reservation in northern Minnesota. Statistics show only about 10% of Native American communities have access to broadband, fast, reliable internet service. As J.P. Rehnquist from WGZS reports, the tribe's initiative also includes a new program to provide technology training and, in some cases, free computers to its members.
Brett Underwood, Director of Technology Programs for Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, is overseeing a noisy crew of workers who are replacing servers and other network components inside the tribe's IT nerve center. This office suite is connected to the internet via a lightning-fast fiber-optic network, but nearby, many homes and businesses are still only able to connect to the internet via old-fashioned phone lines or cellular service, and some people don't have any phone or internet service at all. Underwood says that broadband connections can yield $1,000 to $5,000 a year in annual savings per household.
And that's savings. That's after you have to factor in what they spend for the internet. Well, that's just more of the divide that's happening in Indian country.
With support from the Blandin Foundation's Rural Broadband Initiative, Fond du Lac Band is working to bridge that divide. This week, Fond du Lac Band will offer a series of trainings on how to use the internet, and up to 50 low-income participants will receive a free computer to take home through a partnership with PCs for People. PCs for People is a nonprofit organization that refurbishes donated PCs and shares them with low-income people throughout the Upper Midwest. Diane Soden-Groves, technology trainer for Fond du Lac Band, says that with even a little bit of training and a computer to access it, there is tremendous value in a good internet connection.
Whether it's filing a self-assessment tax, renewing your driver's license, or even banking online, if you don't have that opportunity, it puts you at a disadvantage.
The trainings will be held at the Fond du Lac Tribal Center, and they are open to the public. For National Native News, I'm J.P. Rehnquist.
A Native financial institution has received a six-figure grant from the Bush Foundation to create a workforce development program on the South Dakota reservation. Jim Kent has more.
The Four Bands Community Fund promotes entrepreneurship and business development on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation, but Executive Director Tanya Fittler says employee retention is one of the largest problems among businesses trying to succeed in that community.
Some of the contractors are completing 100 W-2s every year for a crew of 10 or 12. The turnover is so much or so high.
The Four Bands Community Fund plans to address this issue by educating employees about their responsibilities to their employer, as well as reminding employers about the challenges workers in a reservation community may face.
The average non-native, by the time they're 18, may have attended 3 to 5 funerals. For the average Native American child, they've attended upwards of 100 funerals.
Tanya Fittler says understanding the unique cultural needs of their employees is vital to any business on the reservation. Native American employees, adds Fittler, need to incorporate their employer into the holistic attitude of dedication to family and community maintained in traditional Lakota beliefs. Dependability, notes Fittler, is the key to success in the workplace. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
In December 1970, President Richard Nixon signed a bill to return Blue Lake to Taos Pueblo in New Mexico. The lake and surrounding land was taken in the early 1900s by the federal government and became national forest land. Taos Pueblo considers the area sacred and fought for its return. Blue Lake and surrounding mountains are off limits to everyone but Taos Pueblo members. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Kawanic Broadcast Corporation is accepting art for the Alaska Native Art Auction, February 20th, 2014 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event to buy art. Proceeds benefit National Native News. Learn more at knba.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 5 minutes and 51 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska, on a fairly chilly afternoon. It's about 25 degrees out there right now, and it's going to drop all through the afternoon, go down to about, some places around town it could get as low as 2 degrees above zero tonight. And then Wednesday, the clouds will come in a little bit and warm things up. It's going to get all the way up to a balmy 19 on Wednesday and hang around the 20s for the day. So probably not a good weekend to try out your bikini and those things. Maybe you better dig the parka and the bunny boots out and get braced for Arctic conditions. Another way you could do that would be to come in out of the cold at the Canvas downtown. And in front of me right now are Catherine Kell and Brandon Howard. Catherine is the, arts manager or...
Program assistant.
Program assistant at the Canvas. And Brandon Howard is here. He's going to be doing some pottery classes with their new set of offerings that's starting up here. So what all you got going for December? And on into January.
Now. Oh, yeah. Well, first off, we have a full schedule of classes from now up through March. So if you don't hear about, something you're interested in this time, you can go online to our website or check out our Facebook for more offerings. If you're looking for something, coming up this weekend, we got a couple of events. First off, this Friday is going to be movie night at the Canvas. We're going to be showing the Disney Pixar classic Toy Story. We're going to be holding this event in the Canvas Gallery. It's going to start at 6 p.m., and it is a free event, and popcorn is included.
For the entry price of nothing.
Yes.
All right, I like it.
And then if you're looking for something more in the holiday spirit of things, we're going to be holding our second annual gingerbread house decorating class this Saturday, December 21st, from 12 to 4 p.m., the class is going to be run by our own director, Kelly Manning, as well as our artistic coordinator, Chris Taylor. The event, the price is going to be $35 a house, which means you can either collaborate or do your own house. And this price is going to include a prefabricated gingerbread house, as well as a huge selection of candy decor. Spots are limited, so please call ahead and reserve today.
And if they want to call ahead, whom would they call?
They would be calling the front desk of the Canvas and most likely speaking to me. The number there is 586-1750.
586-1750 if you want to get in on this gingerbread decorating house. And that's this weekend, did you
That's
say?
Going to be this Saturday.
This Saturday, yeah. So what time does that start?
12.
Noon, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So open up the afternoon. Now, what do you think, a couple hours to decorate a gingerbread house?
Yeah. The event's going to be 12 to 4, so yeah. You have plenty of time to go as embellished or simple as you'd like.
And you have to eat before you come, because otherwise you'll be nibbling the house and it'll fall over and
yeah.
Like that. So, yeah, very important. Brandon, you're going to be teaching some pottery classes?
Yeah, I've got some classes coming up this next year that I'm pretty excited about. I'll be doing beginning wheel throwing classes. As usual, we like to have a beginning wheel throwing class going pretty constantly. A lot of people are really interested in trying it. But aside from the beginning wheel class, I have some more specific classes, some kind of special topics classes. One that we're going to be doing is throwing big. Working with a lot of clay at once can be pretty intimidating.
Mm.
Most people seem to make bowls and cups and smaller things that only take up to a few pounds of clay. So in this class, everything we do is going to be 10 pounds of clay or more.
Wow.
So thinking, large lidded jars, vases, we'll be doing large serving bowls, really large serving bowls and big platters, teaching people techniques for working with a lot of clay so that you don't have to just get in there and muscle it when it's on the wheel. There are a lot of techniques that help out a lot. Also going to have a special topics where we're just going to be working with a really dark red clay body. Usually in the studio we work with a white clay, which is nice, but this red clay body is one that I like to work with a lot. It's really, really warm and rich. And then glazes are just a completely different thing with it. You get a lot of nice surfaces with it, so it's kind of it's a nice change. Unfortunately, we can't have it in the studio all the time because it's a really small space, and managing red clay, well, it becomes a huge mess really, really fast.
Really? How come?
So much iron in it.
Oh, okay.
It just stains everything. You get it mixed with the white clay, and it has a lot of grit in it. The white clay that we work with doesn't have any grit. It's really smooth. And it just wreaks havoc on us, on studio. And then the other class that we're going to be having a little later on this year in April is libations. And it's going to be looking at clay and how it's gone hand in hand with basically serving and storage vessels for alcohol. So we'll be looking at things like jugs and bottles, as well as, you know, looking at making things like beer steins and kind of having a fun way to work with clay, come up with some different ideas and think about the things that we use and the things that we use in very specific ways. So I'm looking forward to that class. I think that's going to be a fun special topics class also.
Catherine mentioned the webpage down at Canvas. On that webpage, there are some really beautiful examples of some of your own pottery pieces.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. So if you're kind of curious as to, you know, who the teacher is and what he turns out, good samples out there on the webpage for you to kind of take a look at and make a decision about.
Yeah, and yeah. I usually have some things up in the window. That way people can, you know, take a look at my work and see what they're getting themselves into when they're going to take a class with me. I also have a great lineup of kids' throwing classes. We do those Mondays, 3:30 to 5:30 after school. Those are going to be going all winter and into the spring. And we're also going to have another teacher coming in on Thursdays to teach a kids' wheel throwing class from 3:30 to 5:30. We haven't hammered out the dates yet for that, but check back to the website. Gives parents an extra option, having Mondays and Thursdays. And the other thing that I'm really excited about in the studio right now, we've got a new membership plan. It used to be you had to buy a punch card to use the studio. It was pretty expensive.
Yeah.
It was still a great deal. But now the membership, you don't have to worry about how many times you can visit in a month. Instead of having, you know, six opportunities to visit the studio, you can go in as much as you'd like, and it's $60 a month, and it includes all the glazing and firing. You just pay for your own clay. And so there's a growing community down at the ceramic studio right now. A lot of people excited to take advantage of that membership, and it's also, this time of year, a great way, like you said, to stay out of the cold.
Catherine, someone could give a gift membership too, right?
Yes, we have gift certificates available at the Canvas. We can set them at any amount. So if you want to give, you know, just a small amount or an entire class, we can accommodate that.
Mm-hmm. So they just come into the Canvas and arrange that at the desk?
Yep, we can ring them up at the front desk, and we have basically a paper copy of the gift certificate that they can then actually give to the person as a gift.
Well, here's a great idea for a Christmas present. And wouldn't you like to find that under your tree?
Absolutely.
Yeah, a little one-month membership at the Canvas, kind of get your now, if you have the membership, are you limited to just one activity, or can you take advantage of everything?
This is strictly for the ceramic studio.
For the ceramic studio, okay. Now, you have drawing classes coming up as well?
We do. We've got a really exciting drawing class called Morphology, Human Anatomy for Artists. It's being taught by David Woody. It's going to be on Wednesdays, starting January 8th up through the 29th, 6:30 to 9 p.m. And basically, this class is specifically for people who want to develop a good working understanding of the human form. It's going to be combining short slide lectures on muscular and skeletal morphology, drawing from a live model, and individual assistance from the instructor. The class is suitable for all levels, and it costs $170. This includes not only the price of materials, but also the model fee as well. And then another really cool class we have coming up is we have a painting with acrylics class, which is being taught by one of our new teachers, Anari Kulanen. It's going to be on Thursdays, January 16th through February 6th, also 6:30 to 9 p.m. And the focus of this class is going to be teaching people how to handle acrylic paints with confidence and how to turn what has previously been viewed as weaknesses of acrylics, such as their quick drying time, into advantages. The class is going to be $165, and once again, all materials are included.
Son of a gun. The Canvas has just got a real lot of things going on. dropping by and taking advantage of that yourself, but also dropping by and getting a gift certificate so someone with artistic leanings that wants to come down to the Canvas and do that would be a lovely thing to find under a tree now, wouldn't it?
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you so much for updating us on what's going on at the Canvas. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Brandon?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, yep. Nice to meet you today. Lots of art opportunities coming up at the Canvas, and an opportunity in a different art form coming up. Nancy DeCherney is here to tell us about the art form of the short game. It is the time for the Jackputt, an annual event that has grown from a couple of holes in the floor.
I think we're at 11 now.
You're at 11, yeah.
Yeah, I think this means that this one goes to 11.
So in case anyone's hasn't been on the links so far, you might explain what this is.
Well, this is our sixth annual. It was originally, we started it as a fundraiser when we first opened the Jack, just because we needed to help raise money to keep the building open, and that's sort of what it still is for. It's a fundraiser to support the activities at the Jack. It is miniature golf, and different artists each make a hole. So, and every year there's a theme, and this year's theme is movies. We have Batman, we have Sound of Music, Dan Hobson, of course, being a musician, that's his hole. Candy Barons and Barons Mechanical have made Despicable Me with these darling little minions. Let's see, I have to go around. Amelie, the French movie, is being constructed right now. We have Blackfish being made by Rachel Usler, who I think will be in a little while to talk about her artwork up at the City Museum. I am doing The Wizard of Oz with a bunch of monkeys, and we have Night Moods did Alice in Wonderland playing croquet, which is sort of like golf. Let's see, I have to go. I feel like there's 11 of them, and I can't remember anything all of them. So I think we have OET is going to be there. Cycle Alaska is there. Folks are making.
Did you mention Sound of Music?
I got Sound of Music. Yeah, okay. It was Dan Hobson that did that one. And I think that the fire safety people are coming, but I haven't heard from them, so I'm not sure about that. But I think they were going to do Towering Inferno or something like that. Because it's movies, we are going to have an Academy Award. You always get to vote on your favorite hole. And so this year we'll have Academy Awards night, which will be on the 28th, Saturday night. You can get all dressed up. We'll have red carpets, the whole routine. Alaska Brewing is donating beer. It's going to be hopefully a fun and silly evening. So come on out for that. And then on the 29th, we'll have Superhero Day. So you come between 3 and 4:30, there'll be face painting, and you can come as your favorite superhero. We'll have cookies and milk and all that sort of stuff.
Should mention the Academy Awards night on December 28th is 21 plus.
Yes.
Alcohol will be served.
Alcohol will be served, and I think who doesn't enjoy a beer and a golf club? And
now, you've got this set up so that somebody can book the whole course.
Yes, if you'd like it.
Or office party or something like that. Yeah.
And it's a wonderful thing for an office party. Actually, the whole thing, what I've observed over the years is it's a great event for mixed ages and for people who maybe haven't seen each other for a little while or maybe don't know each other really well. So it is a really nice office party because the staff can bring their spouses and their kids and everybody can get along just fine. There's plenty of room on the course. We will open on Wednesday tomorrow at noon, and mostly it's filled up during the day with school classes coming in, so a lot of kids coming in for that. You can book, you can have a private little area just to have a birthday party. For a party of up to 15 is $50, and then you can just rent the entire hall for by the hour if you want to and have just your own family or all your friends. Somebody said to me last year, it's way easier than cleaning my house. I just brought everybody there. That's okay.
Sounds like an outstanding way to avoid having to figure out, A, how to get everything clean, and B, what's going to be for dinner. And I mean, logically, you just go to the 18th hole at the end of the whole thing, right?
Yeah, we'll have, in fact, there'll be popcorn, and since it's movies, I'll probably go get Raisinets and stuff like that. Although, I don't think I'll do the nacho thing. But.
No.
But it's a lot of fun, and I just really have to thank, we get a lot of help for this. The Mendenhall Golf Course loans us the putters, the Play It Again sports people did give us the balls, and we just got, I forgot, we're having the Big Lebowski hole, and we got bowling pins from the Taku Lanes over there. So everybody pitches in and just really helps make this a lot of fun. It's a community, silly community effort. A long time ago, Corey Keeker, when we very first started it, who used to live here, did a little research, and there used to be miniature golf leagues here, and it was highly competitive during the 30s. There were, if you go back and research it in the archives, there's just all this stuff about miniature golf in various buildings downtown.
I can see blood miniature golf.
Yeah, it's sort of,
sabotaging the other team.
Stuffing
sawing the ends off their putters.
I don't know. Yeah, we do have some folks that come with their own putters. They're very serious about it. We do have putters over there that, like I said, are donated by the golf course. But anyway.
So the big question, I guess, that needs to get answered is what do you do with the money?
It helps support the
Jack. Because I think people need to know that.
One of the things that we try to do with the Juno Arts and Culture Center is make it affordable for the other arts groups and just in general for the community to use. So we are able to help pay the rent by making this sort of thing happen, which then means that we can pass that savings along to the rest of the community.
Now, the Arts Center will not always be the way it looks right now. You got a little construction thing going. Yeah, you got great plans going. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, a little bit. We were actually we're in the real early planning stages, but the plan is to leave the Jack building as it is and add on to it, extending towards Centennial Hall and making it a little easier for events that happen at Centennial to overflow into the Jack. Right now, it's kind of, you got to fight your way through the parking lot, which isn't very helpful. And everybody does immediately say, what about the parking? And certainly the parking is an issue that we're all working with in the whole Willoughby district, the whole, I don't know any city in the world that isn't dealing with parking, but it is something that we're aware of. But anyway, we are getting ready to make a make an expansion of the place. It will have a Perseverance Theater has joined forces with us, and they will move their theater, which is in a dilapidated condition in Douglas. They will simply move over, and their home port will be in this building, and then we'll have a second theater that we can use that's sort of in between the church sizes and Thunder Mountain, so there's a regular performance space. We have a consultant coming in January that's going to sort of sit down with all of the user groups. And if you're a user group and I haven't alerted you on this, please let me know, because we want everybody's input. What do we need? What are the sizes? What are the programs that want to go on there? What should we be planning to build? One of the things we are thinking about doing to help pay for it is putting housing and offices on the second and third floor. So I think mixed use is a nice way. It sort of makes the neighborhood more fun and exciting. And who wouldn't want to live upstairs and you just roll downstairs and see a theater piece or something, you know?
Grand idea, as long as it doesn't involve cannons.
Yeah. I don't know. Yes. But anyway, so we do have big plans, and I encourage people to get involved and give me a call and stop by and be interested. And we'll, I'm sure, be coming to everybody in the community with more information.
Well, I'll tell you, the Jack is a happening place. of course, I you know, you and I have known each other for a while, since I came here 10 years ago, and anywhere around you is a maelstrom of things happening. You're a marvel. You really are.
You exaggerate, I'm sure.
No. Anyway, so Nancy DiCerni, thank you so much.
Sure.
Let's do the hours one more time. So starting tomorrow at noon.
Starting and going till 9 p.m.
The Jackpot is open. Runs till 9 until the 23rd. You're open noon to 3 on Christmas Eve.
Uh-huh.
And then you're closed on Christmas Day. And then you open again noon to 9 December 26th. And run it up to the 28th Academy Awards night, 8 to 11 p.m. With red carpets and costumes and the whole thing. The superhero party is on the 29th. And, oh, by the way, it says here on my little sheet about this that the Friends of Library is going to do a story time.
I have to get back in touch with them, because they did that last year and people really enjoyed it. And they said, oh, let's do that again. And then I haven't connected with them. But somewhere along the line, there probably will be story time.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Okay. So you call 586-2787 if you want a putt party pass.
Putt party pass. Say that really fast.
Okay. And or to book a private party into the thing and like that.
Yeah.
The jackpot.
Have to see you there.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
A familiar face on Fairway Drive. He stood 5'8", weighed 185, kind of narrow at the shoulders and broad at the hips, short on his drives and long on his chips, Bogey Bob. Bob took his golf in a serious way, had lessons and played almost every day. He read all the golfing books and such, but you never saw him smile too much. Bogey Bob.
Bogey Bob. Bogey Bob.
Oh, Bogey Bob. On the first tee, he'd always have an excuse. His back was stiff. Couldn't get loose. He hadn't played in many a day. His parakeet just passed away.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 20th of December, 2013. It was on this day, 1880, the first electric streetlights in New York City lit up a stretch of Broadway between 14th and 34th Street, from Union Square up to Madison Square. It would later become known as the Great White Way, lit by 15 carbon arc lights installed by Charles Brush and his Brush Electric Light Company. He'd built his first arc lights back when he was in high school, and he'd worked on them for years, trying to refine them. They were called arc lights because the light was produced by a current traveling between two electrodes. The lights were all installed on this day, 1880. They were going to be lit at 5:30 in the afternoon. The lamps were installed on tall iron posts, about twice as tall as the old coal-powered lamp posts. There was a crowd gathered, the order was given, and the street flared into light. There were thousands of Christmas shoppers out. They wrote in the New York Times, the great white outlines of the marble stores, the mazes of wires overhead, the throng of moving vehicles were all brought out with an accuracy and exactness that left little to be desired. It's the birthday of W.B. Yeats's great love, the Irish revolutionary Maud Gonne, born in Surrey, England, 1865. They met when they were both 25 years old. He fell in love with her right away. He was in love with her for the rest of his life, William Butler Yeats. She was tall, beautiful. Yeats wrote, "I had never thought to see in a living woman such great beauty, a complexion like the blossom of apples." In response to one of Yeats's marriage proposals, Maud Gonne told him, "You would not be happy with me. You make beautiful poetry out of what you call your unhappiness, and you are happy in that. Poets should never marry." Years later, she wrote a letter to him and said, "Our children were your poems, of which I was the father, sowing the unrest that made them possible, and you the mother who brought them forth in suffering and in the highest beauty." And it was on this day in 1803 the Louisiana Purchase was completed for $15 million, about 3 cents an acre, from Montana all the way to the port of New Orleans, doubling the size of the United States. Here's a poem for today by Ellen Bryant Voigt, entitled "Daughter." There is one grief worse than any other, when your small feverish throat clogged and quit, I knelt beside the chair on the green rug and shook you and shook you, but the only sound was mine shouting you back, the delicate curls at your temples, the blue wool blanket, your face blue, your jaw clamped against remedy. How could I put a knife to that white neck? With you in my lap, my hands fluttering like flags, I bend instead over your dead weight to administer a kiss so urgent, so ruthless, pumping breath into your stilled body, counting out the rhythm for how long, until the second birth, the second cry, oh Jesus, that sudden, noisy, musical inhalation that leaves me stunned by your survival. A poem by Ellen Bryant Voigt, "Daughter," from her collection The Forces of Plenty, published by W.W. Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity, Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 26 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest was looking out in her backyard and noticing a big pile of glass the neighbor had dumped there and wondering what to do about it. And so she became incensed and then became kilned and fired a bunch of it and is turning out art with it.
It is true. If anyone has ever seen my yard, it is covered with old windows, which I'm slowly using.
Rachel Utzler is here, and she's the display artist this month over at the City Museum with a number of rain chains and tile coasters for sale over there, and she's going to tell us what a rain chain and a tile coaster look like.
Well, yes, so, basically what I've been doing is reusing old window glass here and there, and so the window glass it's way cheaper than buying all the bullseye glass and getting it shipped up here, and we have plenty of it in this town, obviously. And so I've been reusing that window glass, making tiles, basically, but then I can put little coaster spots on them and call them tile coasters. And then I also have been making a whole series of rain chains, which are actually kind of outdoor. They are outdoor artwork. A lot of people use them for gutter systems down in the corners. But what I've been really looking at more so is actually using them as curtains. I actually do anchor the top and the bottom of them because we obviously know the winds that we have around here. And I have a couple good experimental ones at my house right now, and they've been whipping around and they've been holding steady really well. I'm actually wondering what's going to happen when the ice goes all over it. But basically, those hang in front of your windows or on the corners off your gutter system, and they might not necessarily catch rain as much, but they could guide it into the certain areas where it's going, and they also look great for curtains.
So, Rachel, can you describe the process by which a piece of glass out of a window becomes something like a rain chain or a coaster?
I do kiln work. Okay. So that is going. The step one is basically I'm doing them all in kilns. So I'm taking just this sheet glass, basically, and then recutting it into the forms that I want. I've been making hooks that then I embed in between these sheets in the kiln. So it's actually all just kiln work.
So is this the same kind of kiln you'd fire pots in?
It can be. Basically, it's a really stylish one where it has a portlow controller, so I can really control temperatures, which is really, really crucial when you're doing glass. I can go up, but I'm like, okay, when I'm coming down, I need the anneal thing, so I need it to hold for a certain amount of time, at 900 or so, and then I need it to step down, 12 degrees an hour. And the controller on this kiln, which actually can double because it is a crucible kiln, it can double as a ceramics kiln, but it's very particular and precise for a kiln.
Where'd you get it?
Down in Seattle, basically I got a grant about 3 years ago, I think, where I was going to go and upgrade my existing kiln with a portlow controller. And then I was just kind of like, I might as well just double the money with myself and buy myself a new kiln. And it was probably one of the best investments I've ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially nowadays, they are much more insulated and they're really, really efficient for what I'm doing. Especially right now, I was having a disastrous firing yesterday where I was doing more of a larger cast piece. But, I mean, it has to sit there for about 16 hours on the way down. And it's really helpful when it is actually a very insulated kiln. Plus, it does keep the house warm a little bit.
When you said a disastrous firing, what happened?
Oh, well, I had a little bit of smoke from the wax that was burning out of the molds, and so it just kind of took over my house. And so I had to close off all half of my house and open all the windows and... Yeah, it was fine.
You have this kiln inside. It's not. This isn't out in your yard.
Yes, but I need to have a better ventilation system if I ever do another casting like I just did, which I'm working on.
Sounds like it's time for a fan in the wall or something
exactly
like that.
Exactly what I'm getting.
So the process sounds absolutely fascinating. How large a piece can you work?
It depends on the size of the kiln. So my shelves are about 13 inches round. So that will be, that's pretty much the about a foot is what I can really do per sheet.
And so
but I can
you,
stack a few, too, so I can do a few.
When you make one of the rain chains, are you firing, I notice most of these have 6, 7, 8 pieces down. Do you fire them all in the same firing?
It depends. What I've been also working on is also the texture on the bottom of the glass pieces. So on my shelves, I've actually been treating the shelves to get the texture on it. And so I can basically stack probably about 8 shelves. So I can do about 30 pieces in a firing. And these are all individual pieces that have hooks embedded to them that then I go ahead and string up afterwards.
Did you start out with this glass art, or were you doing other found art before?
Oh, I've been doing found art for many, many, many years. Actually, in college, I was more of a ceramicist.
Uh-huh.
But I think going into glass is one of those things that once you start in ceramics, they always say, oh, you'll end up in glass. They told me this 20 years ago. And look what happened. But glass is really fun. I mean, there's plenty of the material around here. And it's just so precise. Plus, I just love the way you can get light through it. And even window glass. I mean, it looks plain and ordinary, but then I can take this ordinary substance and you're like, wow, with a little bit of texture and it has a little bit more colors in it. And I've been working with a little bit of decals here and there, which burns out to a sienna tone or a sepia tone, which is a few of the tile coasters up at the City Museum have that weird little ghost image sort of thing going on. It's actually the ghost image series just because they didn't come out precisely right. I work with my mistakes really well.
It's interesting to me because what you're doing is there's a lot of technology involved in what you're working with, and it crosses with art in a really interesting way, and that intersection is a fascinating
place. Well,
just because
this is all old window glass, I mean, I've noticed different years of this window glass. Like, I have friends that have given me their windows from a 1910 house, and it turns into a much more blue tone. And then I have some 70s window glass that is, it's all basically float glass, which was all, it's basically rolled onto a sheet of water and tin. So you'll always have one side of window glass that will feel a little bit rougher. And that will also determine whether you have, like, if it's really opaque or if it can be really shiny, depending on what side you have going up, which is sometimes I get it right, sometimes I don't. Once again, I work with my mistakes. But yeah, it's very interesting just working with the glass that is all found, too. Because then I also need to figure out the right temperatures for all these things. I'm getting things dialed in much better than I have in the past. Because when you're working with really nice glass, like bullseye glass, it's made down in Portland. They have a big hot shop where they make all this. The colors are always consistent. The temperatures are really consistent. So that makes it really nice to work with. With float glass, can go any way.
Yeah. Well, as I said, this wonderful place where you come together with technology as complex as a precision thermostat and a vision of something that you want to create and how it's going to come out is a wonderful place to be. I don't know if those are mistakes that you call them so much as maybe that's what the art was supposed to be.
Well, it's all a process.
Yeah.
That's basically what art is.
Yeah.
whether you can work with the mistakes is always a key.
Even as we speak, you have an interesting day job as well. You're working over at the Jack?
Yep. Mm-hmm. I'm your rental director and program assistant over at the Jack. So we're over there right now building the putt-putt golf.
Uh-huh.
It's really kind of fun. I'm getting very excited about it. And I also have those, my tile coasters and rain chains after the month of December when they come down at the City Museum. They are over in the lobby shop also.
Okay, good enough. Well, Rachel Utzler, thank you so much for sharing your art and, quote, mistakes, unquote, with us. I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, Pat. Have a good one.
This is Bird Note. We used to think that Arctic terns traveled 25,000 miles a year, making them the long-distance champions of migration. However, with the advent of satellite transmitters and light-level geolocators, the terns were, for a time, knocked off their pedestal. Scott Widensall, author of Living on the Wind, explains.
We found that sooty shearwaters from Australia were traveling up to 40,000 miles a year.
But now, for the time being, the terns have regained the title.
More recently, scientists working with Arctic terns in Greenland and Iceland have discovered that some of those Arctic terns are traveling 47,000 miles a year. And now, Danish researchers have found that their Arctic terns are traveling 53,000 miles a year. Even here in the Gulf of Maine, where we're sitting and talking, the Arctic terns that breed on the islands off Maine are traveling all the way down to the South Atlantic. Some of them are hooking around Africa and spending the winter in the Indian Ocean and then coming all the way back here. These kind of discoveries are going to accelerate as the technology gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Every one of these discoveries just makes the whole issue of bird migration all that more wonderful and awe-inspiring and almost literally unbelievable.
Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. Hear more stories about the amazing migration of birds at our website, birdnote.org.
Support comes from Dr. John Krellick, offering home sleep testing for sleep apnea. Indicators of sleep apnea may include snoring, tiredness, high blood pressure, obesity, or diabetes. This test is performed at your home in the comfort of your bed. Information at 789-6766.
Tonight on 360 North at 8 o'clock, the Juno World Affairs Council presents Germany's Election, the Emerging Grand Coalition with Bruce Botello. Join Robert Kagan and Neil Conan on Great Conversations at 9. Great Decisions in Foreign Policy is at 10, with Platts Energy Week at 10:30, and This Week in Defense News and BioCentury this week following. It's a great public affairs lineup tonight on 360 North and 360north.org. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
It's about 15 minutes before 4 o'clock. My next guest is here to bring us up to date. We've had quite a little controversy that sprang up earlier this season about the change in school district policy regarding middle school sports travel. And one of the folks who came out of nowhere, kind of, and led the charge to maybe work a change on this is John Kurland. John, you've been up before the Juno School Board, and you're here to tell us a little bit about how you're, I guess you've formed an organization now that is trying to make a change here?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. So we have this group called the Stakeholder Committee on Middle School Sports Travel, is what we've been calling ourselves, for lack of a better name. And the group formed in response to the board's decision in September to prohibit travel for middle school athletics. A group of us, a group of parents and other stakeholders who were concerned about the issue got together shortly after the board's decision and asked ourselves, well, what could we do? We were really surprised that the board took the action that it did and disappointed, as a lot of folks were.
Could you briefly bring us up on what exactly happened? In other words,
sure.
What did the board do in response to what?
Yeah, sure. That's important background. So the board let me back up a little further, actually. Some parents had raised to the board concern that one of the middle schools was allowing middle school sports teams to travel and the other middle school was not. This had been last school year that change had first gone into effect. And so the board was hearing some voices, particularly from the school where travel is not permitted, that, you know, there is something inequitable about that. There had been a lot of discussions at Dantakahini and at Floyd Dryden about how to deal with that issue. And make a long story short, the board in September decided that it was going to prohibit middle school travel, out of Juno travel. The board had done a first reading of that in August at the board's August meeting and then took final action in September. And that policy would take effect with the next school year, so next September. When a group of us had discussed that and what we could do to influence the board's decision here after the decision was made, I went to the board and asked that they consider forming a committee comprised of representatives from the site councils from the two middle schools and the district's activities advisory committee, and have that group look at some of the specific issues that the board didn't seem to delve into too deeply. And the board didn't really want to do that. They didn't want to form a committee that was under the auspices of the Juno School District. But the board was amenable to acknowledging a stakeholder committee and ended up writing us a letter, writing a letter to the public that said if a stakeholder committee were to form and if that committee were to develop recommendations for what the committee views as a better outcome for Juno students and bring that back to the board, the board will consider that and potentially take action to change course. So that's what the board did, and the committee has been beginning its work ever since.
So how many people are on the committee?
You know, that's a difficult question to answer because we've tried to keep this open to everyone. And a lot of people have been tracking the issue, and there's been kind of a core group of us who've been actively involved. But it's a mix of parents, teachers, there have been some coaches involved, and just some community members, business owners and others who are interested in the issue.
Are you holding regular meetings?
Yeah, we have. The way we started was to coordinate with the principals and the site councils and the activities advisory committee just to make sure that all the key players knew that this committee had formed and what was happening. Because we're not under the umbrella of the school district per se, there wasn't really a formal mechanism for us to get the word out. So we started by just talking to people, trying to make sure people were aware of what we're up to. And then we met separately with each of the middle school principals to get their perspective on their existing athletic programs, concerns they have about sports travel and how that can work and difficulties associated with it, and the vision that each of the principals has for the future of athletics at their respective schools. And then after we met with the two principals, a group of us have gotten together to try to hash out, well, based on what we heard, where do we go from here? And the overwhelming emphasis has been on trying to be responsive to the concerns that we've heard, the concerns that individual board members articulated during the board's debate on this issue, and also the concerns that the two principals highlighted. So we're trying very much to be responsive to that. I think a solution to this issue, and it is a complex and contentious issue, but I think a solution is going to lie in being able to be responsive to the concerns that those key players have put on the table. I don't think the board is likely to just reverse course. I think they've articulated some specific issues they're concerned about, and they want some ideas for how to address those issues.
The board, I think, was certainly not unanimous in their vote. I think it was a 4-3 split decision.
It was, that's right.
Yeah. And the other group that has formed as well, does it still exist, something called Save Our Middle School Sports, which was basically a Facebook group?
Yeah, so I'm not clear on the genesis of that, exactly how it formed, but
that's not
the group that I'm involved in, but we have made use of that Facebook group to communicate. So in addition to just using an email list of interested parties kind of by word of mouth, we've been posting all our information on that Facebook site because that has upwards of 200 members, so it really has helped in getting the word out.
The students came forward with a couple of petitions, which they presented to the board with a significant number of student signatures on
right.
them. I think one of them had like 360 signatures on it or something like that. And there was also the students, I think, attempted to talk to the board. I think they wanted to give testimony at the board meeting. I don't know if that actually happened or not. So there are students in Juneau who are affected by this, but there's also a secondary thing which has been raised in the stories that have followed this, and that is the fact that if we don't allow middle school travel to some of the other smaller towns in the Southeast Alaska area, then they may not travel to Juneau to play with us. Is that have you looked at that issue and talked to anyone outside of the Juneau area to get their input?
Haven't really delved into that deeply. The Empire ran a story about that had quotes from a coach in Ketchikan about exactly that issue and expressing some real apprehension about, you know, whether they would continue to come to Juneau if Juneau is not going to go to them.
Do they currently send middle school students to Juneau to play in tournament play?
Other schools do as well, other communities. And so it's a real concern that this is a Southeast Alaska-wide issue. You know, even though Juneau made its own decision, it has repercussions for these other communities.
Cost is, of course, the biggest factor here, as I understand it. I think what the principal originally was attempting to do was to respond to the need to cut costs.
Well, it's interesting because that's the context in which the concern has been raised. But if you dig into it, there's a lot more to it than that. School district funds have not been used to pay for the actual costs of travel at the middle school level. There are appropriated district funds that are used for travel at the high school level, but at the middle school level, they've relied on fundraising for a long time. Now, there are some ancillary costs. There are costs of substitute teachers when the teacher coaches travel and their classes need to be covered. There are staff costs in just making the arrangements for travel and the logistics and so forth. So I don't mean to suggest there's no cost at all, but the actual cost of ferry tickets and what have you is not something that the district has been paying for in the past. So I think that's been a bit of a misconception, is that this has been framed solely as a budget issue, that, you know, times are tough and we need to do less. But in fact, the district has not been putting direct funds into paying travel costs for middle school sports.
Have you been able to isolate like an overall number? Do we know what this program would cost or has cost in the past, what middle school travel would look like?
I don't know that number. It varies because there hasn't been a set schedule of of trips that occurs on a recurring basis from year to year. It varies. Some of the teams don't travel very regularly. You know, they might go once every few years, but it's just nice to have the opportunity that once during a kid's middle school career, he or she might have the chance to go to Sitka or to go to Wrangell or Petersburg or something like that.
What has your group been able to isolate how many students go forward from a middle school sports program into varsity or high school sports?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, too. You know, it would take a fair amount of data mining to get good statistics on that. And because the board was so concerned about not wanting a lot of district resources to be put into this issue, you know, the board kind of felt like, well, we've made our decision. So our stakeholder committee has purposefully held back from asking a lot of detailed data questions to the school district because it would take some time and effort to compile all of that. So really what we've tried to focus on is addressing the concerns that folks have raised and moving forward.
John, what's the next step for the stakeholder committee?
Yeah, so we have been working on developing draft recommendations, and our intent is to release a draft report for review by the two middle school principals and the site councils at both the schools. We also want the Activities Advisory Committee to look at it, and really it would be open to anyone to look at it in draft form. And the whole intent of that is to try to vet it and have people point out anything that we may have come up with that might not be realistic or that might need to be fleshed out a little bit more, any comments or concerns, and give us a chance to address that before we present it to the board. So our hope, not sure if we'll get there, but our hope is to have a draft report available before the end of this month, put that out for review, and then to meet with the site councils and the principals and, you know, answer any questions they may have about it as they consider it, get their comments by the middle part of January. And then we would take the latter part of January into February to address any issues that need to be resolved based on that feedback. And then we're aiming to provide a final report to the school board by the end of February. And the board had said that if we got them input and recommendations on policy changes by March, that the board would consider putting that on the agenda for action at its April and May meetings.
So the board, if you return this over to them, say, the end of February, the board could read it at the March meeting, and if they called a recall vote or a revote on the issue, they could do that at the April meeting.
Actually, it would slide one meeting in advance of that. So we would present it in March, and if they decide to consider a policy change, their first reading would be in April, and then the final action would be in May. But the aim overall is, if the board is going to change course on the policy decision they made in September, to do it so that whatever they come up with takes effect for next school year.
Is there someone, if someone has input or wants to follow this activity or something like that, how do they find out what the stakeholder committee is doing? Are you posting on the web? Is there a phone number people can call? Is there some way people can contact you?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, again, since we're not a school district entity, we're not on the district's website, but I'll just go ahead and give you my home phone number. I'm happy to have people give me a call. And again, my name is John Kurland. And my number is 364-2396.
Well, thank you, John, for updating us, letting us know what the status of this thing is. It kind of has been, with the other things that are going on in the school district, it sort of slid off the table a little ways, and it's nice to have it back and have a nice update on exactly where we're standing on this issue. Thank you so much for coming down and doing
it. Thank you.
City sidewalks, busy sidewalks, dressed in holiday style. In the air, there's a feeling of Christmas. Children laughing, people passing, meeting smile after smile. And on every street corner, you'll hear silver bells, it's Christmas time in the city. hear the bells go ring-a-ling. Hear them ring. Soon it will be Christmas Day.
You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We broadcast on translators. K276AF is in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay. K269AO is in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. K201AM is in Gustavus. K220BT in Hoonah. K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. And in Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on Digital Channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.